You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Well, hello and welcome to TFM's local watering hole, coming at you from Earth 828. I don't actually know how we're getting this message through to you, but goodness, it's coming through. Maybe Galactus is bringing it to our Earth as we've, you know, kicked him out of this Earth. But I'm so excited to be back here with my good friend Yancey Evans to talk about Fantastic Four First Steps. And Yancey, it's great to have you back.
Well, thank you, Matt. It is great to be back. I love getting together with you and going through these little MCU nuggets and talking about what's going on in the world of cinema today. So
yeah.
Let's get right to it.
One of the biggest films of the summer, and we're going to talk about it as we look to dive into that. Before we do, just check us out all over social media. You can follow us on X, Twitter, at the 602 Club. You can find us on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. So follow us on both places. You can find the entire network on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. You can also find us online at trek.fm. Find all the shows we're doing. And you can support the network over at Patreon at patreon.com/trekfm. If you like what's happening here, support the show and help support the show in the biggest possible way. Give us a star rating and review over on Apple Podcasts. Help people find the show in that way. Also, did you know that recommending a podcast to a friend or on social media is the best way to grow a podcast audience? So do that for us. We would really appreciate it. So, Yancey, I was looking back and we kind of had somewhat of a similar conversation with Thunderbolts coming out, right? But I think it's a good conversation to talk about coming into this movie because meta-wise, we already know that what's coming next is the big next thing, which is Avengers Doomsday. And so coming into this, what we've had for Phase 4 for films, and I'm just going to talk about the films. There's a lot of shows, obviously, that have happened, but this is what's come out in the cinema. This is what's come out in cinema. We had Black Widow, Shang-Chi, Legend of the Ten Rings, Eternals, Spider-Man No Way Home, Doctor Strange The Multiverse of Madness, Thor Love and Thunder, Black Panther Wakanda Forever. Then we began Phase 5 with Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, Guardians of the Galaxy 3, The Marvels, Deadpool and Wolverine, Captain America Brave New World, and of course Thunderbolts asterisk, which just came out this year, as did Brave New World. So coming into this film, where are you Marvel-wise? How does it feel like this all maybe kind of connects in any way? Because we know what's coming, I think it's hard to ask the question because as I read that list, there's no cohesion there really.
Yeah. You know, the thing that's funny is you say, well, without including the TV shows, but unfortunately, half that list requires the viewing of a TV show to kind of get the full concept. For example, Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, you really need to see WandaVision to figure out what the hell is even going on in this film. Sure. The problem with Phase 4 and Phase 5 in particular is what you just said. There's no cohesion whatsoever. There's no through line that you can see where any of this is making any sense. We were going into the whole Kang thing, and then the actor had some personal problems and that was no more. And to quote the great Jack Nicholson, From Batman, This Town Needs an Enema. And, you know, this series needed an enema. It needed some kind of a flush and restart kind of thing. And I think, you know, at least for me, that's kind of where Fantastic Four was a welcome surprise, because it didn't require you to watch anything else. You could just go into it blind and start over with the MCU. Now, of course, the question, of course, is then, well, yeah, there's all this other stuff, because it's leading into Doomsday, which requires all this other stuff that you need foreknowledge of. I don't know how that's going to work. I hope it works. I'm just going to, you know, I'll basically talk about the film with its merits, because it really is such a one-off compared to what Marvel's been doing lately, which that's one of the reasons I enjoyed this film so much. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those places where, and I think, you know, when I think of coming into this and where we are, Marvel is a victim of its own success and its own rules that it's set up for the universe that it's created, which is everything matters.
Right.
And it almost feels like the whole Incredibles thing. Well, if everybody's special, nobody's special. And we've gotten to this place where we've had such a glut of characters and stuff that it has become hard to follow any through line as to where we are going. And so, yes, you get to a movie like Fantastic Four where we're talking about in a second. We're literally in another universe that is – it's a different Earth. And so we're not on the same Earth that we've been in. And we're going to tell a story about characters we've never seen before on this Earth that we've been in the whole time. And really, there's going to be almost no acknowledgement of other universes other than a couple of mentions here or there. But they're not pivotal to this story. And so it's one of those places where I almost think Marvel has shot itself in its own foot when it comes to how they've released this film, when they've released this film, and just the way in which phases 4 and 5 have been such a cluster of movies that seem to have little to no relevance to one another, as do the shows. And so it's a strange place. And so, like you mentioned, one of the things that this movie does is the setting is on Earth 828, which is a reference to Jack Kirby's birthday, who is the creator of the Fantastic Four. And the Fantastic Four, of course, are the family of the MCU, right? I mean, they are the linchpin kind of from way to the beginning. But I wanted to ask you about this setting, because we have this new place we've never been before here. And how does it work to be kind of introduced to these characters on this new Earth? And the biggest part about this new Earth is it's very different than the one that we've been on for so long. This is like Tomorrowland on steroids. If you've seen that Disney film, we basically are introduced to a world that is run by an authoritarian techno-utopian futurism foundation in the Future Foundation, which is run by the Fantastic Four, because, you know, they have powers, so we'll hand them the keys to the entire Earth. What do you think of this setting? Because it is a massive part of the film, and yet it is barely paid attention to in some
ways.
Well,
I think
in the film.
There's two aspects to this. I think one, the vibe that this film is very much going for is this retro futuristic vibe that came out of the 50s. It was primarily based out of what NASA was doing and what we were doing with the space program,
right,
and where we were going to go, and that science would ultimately be the solution to all the world's problems. You know, that continued into themes through Star Trek, you know, that if we just got smart enough and the world got it together and there was enough science, we could figure out all of humanity's problems. Yeah, exactly. And we would have no more wars. We'd have no more starvation. You know, everything would be grand. I have no problems with that, because that is kind of the future that Jack Kirby originally presents in the comics. That's kind of, it's this hopeful ideal. It's like the 1960s, but if the Jetsons lived in the 1960s, so the technology is way more advanced than what we had at the time. So I found that kind of cute and humorous. It does, in a contemporary world, it does raise some questions, because we have lived in this world where science has been so almost imperial in its way it can crush people and their own independence. I actually think that's going to probably play into the next film, because that's something they're going to have to deal with as a superhero group, is a world that will actually push back against them when they say, hey, we're going to do this thing, and just assume that everybody's going to be, yeah, you guys are right, go do it. So I think that's something that's going to probably play a part of the mm-hmm. story going forward. We'll see. I agree with you, though. Marvel's in a really weird spot, because it is a reset, but there's all this stuff that's coming behind it that's going to require the same homework that you were having in phases 4 and 5. So, that's just, I don't know how that's all going to play out.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I think is most interesting, and I think you're right in the sense of, this is very much based in the thought process of somebody like Jack Kirby when he's creating this, the vibe of the time, right? And the idea of there being a techno-utopian futurism that's going to save us, technology and science are going to save us, it was definitely a thing of that day.
Right, because you got to remember, let me interject this one thing. You got to remember at the time, they're dealing with the bomb. So there's the threat that the world could end at any minute. And the solution is more science. If we could just science our way out of this scientific problem we've created, we can fix this, you know? So.
Yes. And yet, I think what's kind of fascinating is that both of the biggest summer movies kind of deal with the idea of techno-authoritarianism. Superman deals with this, of course, with Lex Luthor, but he's the bad guy. It also deals with the question of, power and how can it be utilized in our world, and just because you have power, does that mean you should get to utilize that power, right? And what I found so fascinating about Fantastic Four is it doesn't care about any of those questions. It literally just says, hey, this is a world where almost every single country has just handed the keys to the world, to the Fantastic Four, because they have power, and because they have these powers. And it's like, okay, I guess that makes them better than everybody else just because they have power. Are we saying might makes right in this world? And we also see it being utilized kind of indiscriminately by Mr. Fantastic when he just decides, I'm going to baby-proof the world, so I'm going to start rounding up all the criminals with no due process with my future robots. It's like there are all these things that are actually really troubling about the film, and yet they never have any time to answer. Hold on one second.
Go ahead. Sure.
I'm just going to say, I don't think we'll ever get any answers to this, because they're going to come to our world or our universe, and their world is not going to necessarily matter anymore. And so there's a sense to me with this, as much as I enjoyed being in a world where I can just jump into it, it's this movie just raised so many questions that I had no desire to answer or deal with, that I was just frustrated. And I wanted there to be a little bit more dealing with the reality of the things that they're creating in this universe. And on top of that, I think a big part of this is that the movie is going at such a breakneck speed to be done in an hour and 55 minutes that we're not giving adequate time to just about anything really in the movie, because most of this movie is really told in just big montages instead of a lot of really well-crafted scenes about characters. And so to me, those are some of my, like, the setting just is one of those places where it's given to us and it's never really paid attention to as if it's important. And I was just really frustrated by that, because it's actually kind of a terrifying setup, if you ask me.
Well, I disagree, because I think the primary themes of the film are family, like specifically the scene where he's trying to baby proof the world. He does get called out by his wife and the other teammates that,
yeah, but they don't stop about from to doing enter, it. You're about neither to does anybody else in the world.
Right. You're about to enter a world where you have no control over everything. So you need to stop this, because you can't. You can't control that. So I think I don't think it was trying to tell those kinds of themes as much as it was trying to tell the themes of a family and its internal struggles. And there's a lot of that throughout the film. I think for me, the pacing was perfect, because we didn't get the classic MCU. We're just going to throw a ton of characters at you with no frame of reference. And who are these people? We're focused, laser focused on these four people and what this team is doing, you know, to save the world, and the internal stuff that's going on with it. There's a lot of stuff. I really appreciated the fact this is actually the first Fantastic Four movie that actually addressed the fact that Johnny Storm is actually a really smart guy. You know, he's not, not just a throwaway beefcake kind of ladies man character, you know, because he still gets his ladies man moments, but he's a scientist as well.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of that, and the story is very tight. I like movies that are told under 2 hours, because I honestly think most superhero movies, the problems with them is they're just too damn long. If you can't, if you're telling an action adventure movie and you can't really do it with a 2 hour time limit, I'm like, you know, so I thought there was a lot of, I honestly felt the film was incredibly well paced, well written. I thought there were plenty of great character scenes. I get what you're saying. I mean, you know, I honestly would love to have seen what John Malkovich's character was all about. I want to know, you know, because that's a whole side story that got excised at the last minute. You know, it's like, apparently it's like a 10-minute side story with John Malkovich, and that's gone. You know, so it needed a little bit more room to breathe, but
my pushback would be is that the movie's setting and breakneck pace don't work as well for these characters, because these are not characters to which we know a ton about. These are not characters like Superman, right? Where everybody knows the story, you know, kind of like, just because it's so ingrained in our culture. The Fantastic Four is not that way. And I think there are places where they kind of skip over a lot of really kind of very important character moments in just, again, in a montage type setting. And they do this with the setting too, just of the world that we're in, by glossing over these really important things that we don't get to spend time with. For you, as somebody who knows the Fantastic Four really well and knows Marvel really well, this stuff makes sense, you know? I would say it's akin, honestly, to the difference between the Harry Potter books and the movies, where, you know, if you've read the books, the movies make sense. But if you actually watch the movies without reading the books, it doesn't make as much sense, actually, story-wise, because there's a lot of stuff that's important that's kind of missing. And that would be my argument here, is that this movie actually needed a little bit more time just for the introduction of who these characters are and their world to make me actually care about it as somebody who doesn't know the Fantastic Four outside of the few movies that I've seen. And you can do that setup in Superman, like James Gunn did this summer, at a breakneck speed, and people can follow along very easily because everybody knows that story. You can't just drop people in this way. And that's one of the things I think, you know, the original Marvel films, with starting with Iron Man, you know, Iron Man's what, a C-list character at that point? And they make him basically an A-lister. But they also make you care about him by bringing you his full arc in that movie. I felt like, as somebody who doesn't necessarily know the Marvel universe as well, I would like to have had, I'm not asking for 30 more minutes, right? You can do a lot in 10 minutes on film. So I think that if we had just maybe had 10 more minutes to be able to be with these characters, I believe it would have been more helpful. And it would also have been more helpful for just even the setting.
Well, I tend to think of this, to me, this film feels more like a phase one movie, because it gets to the point with the, you know, they could have relitigated the origin story of the Fantastic Four. And I'm glad they didn't, because I think that's been done to death. As far as, you know, there's two separate movies about the origin of the Fantastic Four. So I think I really enjoyed the little, you know, whatever it was, 5 to 10 minute intro, you know, the ABC special intro, with the, Fantastic Four. Now, you know, I think they could have played around a little more showing them fighting some of their, you know, like they really don't get into Mole Man that much, 'cause he's like their first, arch nemesis. It was funny because my daughter was like, after the movie, she's like, wait a minute, they took that from the Incredibles. I'm like, no, the Incredibles took that from from the Fantastic Four. Yeah. You know, the Underminer is Mole Man. And so she's like, oh wow, I didn't know that. Yeah. So I you know, they could have played around with that a little bit, but I think in terms of pacing and how the movie moved along, it's a lot more in the realm of an Iron Man or a Captain America. It's trying to get to, it's a lot. It's definitely a lot more of an old school movie than most contemporary superhero movies are. It's shot very old school. There's no shaky cam at all. It's very,
yes. It looks very much of a time of the 60s, right? Yeah.
So, that's one of the things that attracted me a lot to the film, is there's not,
and I think I would argue with you that's one of the strengths, is that it, when it comes to like the look and the feel of the film, it's very authentic to that. It really has a focus in that sense. It knows what it wants to look like, what it wants to feel like, and it very much sticks to that. You bring up The Incredibles, though, and that's a movie that basically does the Fantastic Four the way this movie wants to do it, and does it way better. Like, it's a 100% a much better film. And part of that is because that movie also knew when to slow down enough. Even though it's an animated film, it slowed down enough, made me care about all of the characters involved in a way that I will argue this film never does. So, and which I think is a great time maybe to just like dive into the cast, because obviously the cast is a big deal in this film. You got Pedro Pascal and Vanessa Kirby and all of these people. And so first we got to talk about Pedro Pascal as Reed Richards, Mr. Fantastic. In fact, when they first wanted this, when they were first looking towards casting this movie, they actually wanted Adam Driver and Emma Stone, but they asked for too much money. And so they said no. I think that's a real loss, because Adam Driver is a much more interesting actor, I think, in this role. Because to me, the weakest link in this movie and the worst performance in this movie, and somebody I never bought in this film and just had no connection with, that really then hurt the rest of the movie, because his connection with Sue Storm is the most important piece of this film, is Pedro Pascal. He is so boring in the role. He has no charisma in the role. And I get that the character is supposed to be like the smartest man in the world and like a walking computer, but you can do that in a way that's more interesting than what we get, which is this kind of like, it's just flat and wooden and it's not interesting. And I needed basically, you know, everybody wanted somebody like a John Krasinski, and yeah, Adam Driver, I think, would have been much more interesting because, man, the dude can do so much with nothing. And I've seen Pedro Pascal be great. I mean, gosh, the dude just uses his voice for The Mandalorian, and it's fantastic. But this performance was, I'm sorry, it was not good.
Well, I disagree. I thought he was great, but I can understand where people come from with that point of view. But I think he plays Reed Richards perfectly, because Reed Richards was always obsessed with, you know, he is kind of the ultimate control freak. He's trying to use his powers for good, but to control things, and he's trying to control like the outcome of how am I going to, you know, resolve this issue or resolve that issue. The, the scene that sold me completely though on him was the scene where they're talking about, they get back after the big chase with Silver Surfer, and they get back to Earth, and they're talking about what's to be done, because the out obviously is giving Franklin, their baby, to Galactus.
Yeah.
And the scene where you can tell in his mind he's playing, and you can see it straight in his eyes. And Vanessa Kirby, Sue Storm, says, you've already calculated this, giving up Franklin. And he basically has to defend himself. Like, look, I'm not going to give up the baby, but it's still something because my scientific mind requires me to look at all. It's like Mr. Spock. It requires me to look at all the possibilities. Yeah. And that is a possibility I do have to consider. But I'll never do that.
Right.
You know, and she doesn't take that too well, naturally, like no mother would. Yeah. And so there's a couple of really great scenes with him after that. I think he played that well. I actually, there's a funny little anecdote. He wanted to do kind of this when he originally pitched, you know, when he was originally being brought in to test for the role. He wanted to do this affectation, this mid-Atlantic accent, you know, kind of that 30s, 40s kind of rapid fire radio talking guy. You know, he wanted to be a little more in that kind of vein.
Yeah.
And they were like, no, we're not going to do that. And I'm like, that almost would have worked, but that's okay. Cause I do, you know, he does play things a little understated, and maybe this role needed a little bit more oomph in a couple of scenes, but I thought the scenes where he needed to be more internal and more, you know, kind of the thinking, you know, the walking computer type man, I thought he did that real well. And that was my biggest concern with him when he was being cast, other than the fact that he's in everything, is could he play that part? Could he legitimately come across as a scientist? And I thought he did that part rather well.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting that you say that he kind of had this idea of doing that mid-Atlantic accent that all of the stars had, you know, in those 40s and 50s films, and even somewhat into the 60s. And so, and I honestly think it would have given him more range to play with. I just don't like the choices, and I can't just blame him. Honestly, I'm going to blame the director for not allowing him to play with the role more. And because you can play what he's being asked to play, but you can do it more charismatically. And obviously, we've seen Pedro Pascal be charismatic, right? That's why he's in everything right now, because people have seen him be an actor that they've responded to. And I just think it's interesting to me that the other issue that I ran into is that I did not feel like he had great chemistry with Vanessa Kirby, which is weird because of the press tour, and we'll just leave that there. But
please,
I didn't feel their chemistry together, which to me very much kind of hurt look, they're the absolute crux of this film, because their dilemma as parents and becoming parents that are, you know, superhuman now, and what is going to happen with their child. I mean, this is the biggest question, and their dynamic is the thing that really is supposed to carry this movie. And because I'm not really buying Pedro Pascal as this character, it also hurts the interactions then that he has. And I was disappointed in that too, because you kind of need them to work as a couple to buy the rest of the movie and really get drawn into any of the emotional stuff that they do want you to feel. And that's the thing is I leave this movie, because of the performance of Pascal, actually just feeling very little. There are a few scenes where I kind of felt something, where I'm like, oh, that kind of gets me. Otherwise, I'm just not feeling a lot during this movie, and I should be feeling something, because I know the movie wants me to, but I'm not feeling it in the way that they're intending me to, and I think a lot of that comes down to that performance and then the way it impacts the biggest relationship in the film.
Yeah, I disagree with that, but that's okay. We can do that. I thought the relationship worked. I thought she's more the feeling, not necessarily face, because obviously Mr. Fantastic is on TV and stuff that, but he's more the television science guy persona, and she's more the feeling mother, you know, who's presented mm-hmm. to the world as kind of like the heart of the group, along with the thing being kind of like the heart of the group. And I thought they had really good chemistry. I thought there were a couple of scenes in particular where their relationship worked real well. I loved their performances in the scene where she's giving birth. I thought it was great watching him vacillate between panic of all these things he's having to do simultaneously. I think he had to do like three things at once, use his powers to do various things on the ship, along with holding down his wife, because she didn't want to be strapped down by, you know, by belts and stuff like that. And so I thought they had a great chemistry, but it is a different kind of thing than you see a lot in, but that I think it's a nature of the characters. I really do. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think,
but Vanessa Kirby was fantastic. She was really
good. I agree. I'm glad you feel that way, because I felt like she did a really good job in the movie. I felt like that she really portrayed this woman who obviously has an incredible powers, right? And yet at the same time is a woman who is devoted to motherhood and her child. I mean, I just absolutely loved the way in which the movie has this beautiful message of life, you know, as we, you know, get to see the baby in the womb. I mean, what an incredible thing to see on screen. I mean, that's the place where I was really having emotions, is those moments, and that she is, you know, willing to do whatever it takes to protect her family and her child, I thought was phenomenal, right? And so,
yeah, there's a great line I think she has where she says, I don't know how it was phrased. She basically phrases it, she would basically do anything for her child, you know, but she wouldn't, she wouldn't give up her child for the sake of the world, but she wouldn't give up on the world
for the sake
of her child.
Yeah.
Which I thought was just a fantastic message.
Yeah. And I thought it was it was really well said. That was probably one of the best lines of the film. And so, but no, I think she's really great. And I really liked her performance in the film. And that's the thing where I wish that she felt more connected than to the person that she's supposed to feel the most connected to in the movie. And again, I think that just comes back to them kind of pulling back Pascal from having the charisma we know he can have, for maybe a fear that he's going to come off as, I don't know, whatever. So, but Ibn Moss Bacharach playing Ben Grimm was great. And unfortunately, the thing gets nothing to do in the movie.
I wanted him to have one more scene with Natasha Lyonne. Really needed one more scene with them because they got it there, but mm-hmm. they didn't go all the way. Mm-hmm. But that was one scene I think we could have used a little more of. He doesn't really get to use his powers much until the end of the film. And obviously in the opening when he's doing some when they're doing the montage of their origin story. But that's also kind of, you know, again, that's kind of the thing in the comic. He doesn't really thing out, you know, to use the Hulk term. He doesn't really do clobber in time until it's absolutely needed. So, because he is kind of more of a gentle giant type character. I actually would have liked to have seen one more scene with him and Natasha Lyonne, because they established that thing. And it was just like, I want a little bit more. Yeah. It's like
He's really good in the role, and I think the thing that really comes across in The Betrayal is he sells the sorrow of being the thing and not being a normal human being who truly is in love with this woman. I think it's interesting, too, of them portraying kind of his Jewish heritage as well, going to synagogue. This is one of the places where I think the movie does a disservice to one of its characters by not giving adequate time to more character development, because he really has those moments where you're just wanting them to take it to the next level. And in another movie, they would take it to the next level because they would maybe even give 5 more minutes of screen time to this character to do that. And you could have done that. It's not like anybody's going to say no to 5 more minutes of Fantastic Four, you know. I was sad about that. And the other, you mentioned earlier, but Joseph Quinn as Johnny Storm, allowing that character to have full dimensions as a character and not just be the hottie snack.
Yeah, you know, so that was actually one of the castings I was the most worried about. When they announced him, I was like, okay, he's a good actor, but I just can't see him as Johnny Storm. I don't see it, you know. But then as soon as he's on screen, it's like, oh, okay, I got it. I get what they're going for. And you know, that it's funny because this is the one thing I hate about all actors when they're going through their promo tours for their movies. They always say stupid things. They always say something that's factually inaccurate, you know. And he made the statement that they were gonna, you know, he didn't like Johnny Storm being, you know, kind of the ladies man kind of thing, and you weren't gonna see that on the screen. And I'm like, well, you kind of did. They just didn't make it as overt as like the 2004 Fantastic Four, which is completely fine, because I thought the 2004 version was a little too much, you know. It's just like, yeah, okay, you've made Chris Evans out to be kind of a Nimrod and that's not the character. So I thought he really just nailed it, though. And I loved him having that huge moment where he's able to translate the Silver Surfer's language and speak to her. That was just, that was great stuff.
Yeah, I agree too. Because the other character that they, I think they really made something of is Shalabal Ball with Julie Garner playing the Silver Surfer. And, you know, they give you this character, of course, who has made the decision in some ways that Storm and Fantastic are faced with, right? Are you going to give something up for the salvation of your world? And so the performance is great, and this is one of the places where the effects always work, which is good, because you need her to feel very real as a character, and she always does, which is great. Great performance by her.
Yeah, she was fantastic. I love that whole subplot, and frankly, the I haven't seen, I can't even recall the last time I saw as good an action scene in a Marvel movie as the chase scene with the Silver Surfer and the Fantastic Four. That with the Michael Giacchino score and, just the rapid fire cutting back and forth and the stakes just continually going higher and higher and higher. It was a great little sequence.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about then real quick with the action and the effects. I agree that the action itself is kind of well thought out for the most part, and does feel very different in that sense than a lot of Marvel movies recently. It's more exciting, it's more interesting, it's more visually appealing for the most part. I think that for me, this movie though does suffer from the fact that the effects themselves are not always consistent, and so there are moments or there are characters that always look great, but then there are other parts of the action which don't. And so, and what you need is just consistency, like so that I'm not drawn out. And so, there's good things on that and bad things on that. And that was a little bit frustrating to me that I just wish it had been slightly more consistent, because in the battle, say like the end with Galactus and the scene with Fantastic,
being stretched
getting
and his face
becoming
clearly
Stretch
being paced
Armstrong,
on.
it looks bad. And so, yeah, there are those places where those don't look as good, but then there are other places where you're just kind of like, wow, that looks amazing. And so that back and forth, that's the problem again. As long as the effects work is consistent, you'll never be pulled out. And so that's what you should be striving for in VFX, more
Yeah,
so than just perfection.
I think what they were really more focused on was making sure Galactus looked real and looked menacing and fit within the world, which they succeeded on all levels with that. But then there are moments like Franklin at times, even though apparently they used a baby for everything, they didn't CG a baby, but it all has to do with composition. And if your composition is off,
Yeah,
the character doesn't
exactly.
look like they're in the scene. It looks like they've been pasted in the scene. Like the scene you're talking about in specific, the problem wasn't Mr. Fantastic stretching. His body was fine. It was the pasting on of Pedro Pascal's face in a stretched
All of
out
that stuff,
version that didn't look like that was part of his body. It looked like somebody put that in at the end. It's like copy paste. There we go. There's his face being stretched. I thought overall the effects were fantastic through almost all the film, but there were times I would say by leaps and bounds, this is probably the best looking Marvel film in years as far as effects. Compared to most other projects, I can't even, except maybe Spider-Man.
I mean, I wouldn't say I would say that's probably like the best looking in maybe the last 2 years, because Guardians of the Galaxy 3 looks amazing.
Yeah, that looked good.
I mean, and partly because more than most directors these days, James Gunn knows exactly what he wants from the action and plans accordingly while they're shooting, and is then able to tell the VFX way ahead of time, this is what I want, this is what I'm looking for. Which is why, regardless of whether or not the movie looks perfect, it always looks consistent because the VFX team has enough time to be able to work on it to create that consistency. As we know, too many Marvel movies end up changing things last minute, which leads to effects not being as consistent then. You end up with those that look amazing because they've been working on them for almost the entire run of the film, and then you have the other effects that they did in 2 months. There's a huge difference between the two. I got a question for you. So one of the things that really throws me off about this film is they are orbiting a black hole for a very long time in this movie. And yet the time dilation for them to be gone is only a month.
Yeah, I don't. That was one I threw in there is that's your standard comic book science.
Yeah, because, I mean, the problem is that we all live in a world where, you know, Interstellar exists.
Yeah, I know, so. But they all do. I mean, they all do that. The whole thing with the black hole and Superman was kind of, goofy as well. It's just, it's comic book science. It's like, it meets the needs of what the story needs. You know, so what they do is they make the concession, okay, yeah, this would probably have taken them decades to get home, but we're going to concede it's going to be a month. You know, so that's the conceit. We'll give you a month. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
You know,
it was one of those places where I wish that they had at least made it like half a year.
The stakes, you don't want, well, Galactus is going to show up in half a year. You know, it's just, you know, because everything is really, you know, that's the thing. Everything's really crunched down. Like they, in terms of time, like, for example, they're able to build all the portal devices in 72 hours, which that's futuristic, you know,
it's globby, dumb.
Gobbledygook Trek sci-fi. It's like, hey, okay, we're all working together, you know, kind of thing, which I laughed at that because I was just like, That was so 50s, 50s era, you know, I don't want to call it propaganda, but, you know, kind of raw America kind of film, you know, kind of, yeah, we're all working together across the world, you know.
Well, and that was one of those places, again, with that question of like time, again, you didn't need it to feel like they're doing this in 2 days. That doesn't really help. It was because obviously in a comic book you would be like the next panel 3 months later, you know. I did want to ask you also about Galactus as the villain, because it's interesting, there is such a Star Trek the Motion Picture quality to him as a villain, that there's just this there's this drive, right, to feed, to gain knowledge.
I would argue that's probably where a lot of V'ger came from.
Yeah.
It was the idea of Galactus, which was already out in the world.
But, you know, it's interesting because it's not quite an evil thing. It just seems to be running on almost like animal instinct.
Right.
And one of the things with Galactus then as the villain that they don't make it incredibly clear in the film is that, so if Franklin takes his hunger, does he just become a new Galactus? Or does he actually stop Galactus from needing to do any of this and save quadrillions of lives across the galaxy?
Yeah, well, I think Galactus kind of says that in the dialogue. You know, he basically says, you know, taking Franklin will quench my hunger, because Franklin's powers are really, like, he's got like crazy powers that we haven't even touched on. You know, later, that's in the comic books. Galactus has always been, for pretty much the most part, he's more of a force in nature. He's not necessarily, he's a villain in the sense, to me, he's more like a Trek, you know, where they don't like to call him villains. They're just like a, they're an arch nemesis. They're something that has to be overcome, you know, and Galactus falls in that kind of category. He is literally a galactic force of nature that consumes planets to power himself and continue on consuming more planets. So I thought that the portrayal was great. I don't know that you needed to know a lot about him. I thought they did a sufficient job of explaining what his motivations were, but I could see how someone might be like, what exactly does Franklin have to do with all this?
Right, right.
I think that's the thing, is maybe explaining what Franklin's, but they don't know. That's the whole thing. Galactus knows, but they don't know yet what his true nature is.
Well, I think that as somebody who doesn't really know, right, So you're saying no, but I'm not clear on if this just creates Franklin as a new Galactus. Because if that's the case, then yes, you say no. You don't want the Galactus to continue. But if your child can keep Galactus from destroying other worlds, and you're literally just sending Galactus into who God knows where that will possibly destroy other worlds, it's like the moral and ethical implications of that are not dealt with at all in this film. And it is another place where the movie isn't actually thinking about the ramifications of the questions it's asking or not asking.
I don't agree with that, just because the whole point is, would you give up your child to save the world? You know, are we truly going to live in a society where the needs of the, you know, like where people just become things? So we're just going to give up Franklin because we might save everybody. Well, we may not. That's a question.
But I think the bigger question is this, because they don't make it clear. Is Franklin going to save the entire universe because Galactus will cease to be? And so if you had made that clear that
well, I think the idea is that Franklin will cease to be if they give him Galactus.
Again, I think that this is so unclear that it makes the choice that they make not be so easy for me to say that they did the right thing. I'm not saying we need child sacrifice. What I'm saying is that they needed to make clear the belief for Sue and for Reed. If we give Galactus to, if we give Franklin to Galactus, we save our planet, but Galactus just continues in the form of Franklin. And if that's the case, it makes it very crystal clear to me. Oh, it's so easy to like say, yeah, we don't do that, you know. But if Franklin can bring an end to Galactus once and for all, we just don't know the impact it's going to have on Franklin. I think that makes the question slightly different.
That's the conversation that Sue and Reed have, you know, when he's contemplating giving. You know, where he says he's not going to do it, but he at least considers the option. What does this look like? So I do think it's addressed. I don't think it's like, I don't think it's like necessarily obvious, but I think it's implied, certainly. So
maybe I do. It's just one of those places where I wish the film was slightly clearer. And I think it's one of those spots again where there's an idea presented, but I would have asked the screenwriter to think about the implications more strongly and make sure that then the intended implication for the audience is what we receive, and so that it's not quite so nebulous. And one of the things, though, that we're going to agree on, I know, is that this movie has a score that it doesn't deserve.
It's one of the best superhero scores in recent memory. I can't even. But that's Michael Giacchino. He pretty much always delivers. You know, if he's on associated with a project,
for the most part, yeah,
yeah, it's gonna be good. So
it's great. And the funny part is if you go and listen to the score for Tomorrowland. And then you listen to this score.
It's all over the place.
It's very, very similar. But the music.
I honestly only had one complaint about the score of the film. And you know what it was? It wasn't the score. It was the end credits. I hated the song that they put at the end of the end credits.
What was that song choice?
I wanted. So for any of the geeks out there who listen to the soundtrack, they have a Herbie's Lullaby. I wanted that instead of the stupid song because you at least hear parts of Herbie's Lullaby in the movie, and that would have been funny. That would have been a good little comic interlude for the end credits sequence. I would have enjoyed that quite a bit.
Can we quickly just mention how wasted Herbie is as a character? He does literally nothing in the film. I was like, I was hoping that there would be something more to him, but it was just more like, That's how he is.
I mean, he helps Reed, you know, and he's kind of like there, you know, that's what he does. Hmm. Now, in the funny thing is, I think it was 1980, there was a cartoon series, and this would actually introduced Herbie. He actually replaced Johnny Storm because it was cheaper to illustrate a robot than it was to illustrate a flame guy. So they got rid of Johnny Storm and replaced him with Herbie. But that was, you know, the days of, you know, shows like Flash Gordon and Star Trek and Scooby-Doo, where they're clearly using the same art over and over, like the same chase over and over, just changing the background and stuff like that. So
where do we stand by the end? Because the mid-credit sequence obviously connects us with the fact that the next film is Doomsday, and Dr. Doom being there talking to Franklin. I honestly don't know because
what screwed it all up for me is, okay, so the Thunderbolts end credit sequence. Are we going to see at the beginning of Doomsday? Is it going to take place on 828? And then then the Fantastic Four has to escape to the New Earth, and that's where we catch up? I don't know. That's part of the reason why I wish they would stick to more of the old school phase one mid and post credit scenes, where there might be something that led directly to the next movie, but for the most part, it's just a cute little anecdotal scene. You know, that's not
the
really...
best one ever. So you stayed through the credits.
Yeah.
You know? And yes.
That's the problem, though, is it's Thunderbolts. That was directed by the Russo brothers, that post credit scene. And they're directing Doomsday. Do those lead right into one another? I don't know.
This is Beauty and the Beast. Flowers, chocolates, promises you don't intend to keep.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
I mean, that's what's happened with so many of these.
There are so many things, so many storylines we've forgotten about in these post-credit scenes. I would love to do a video just covering all the unfulfilled promises.
You have 47 hours of time on your hands?
Yeah, exactly.
Look, I do think that this is one of the issues with this movie being where it is. Because by the end, we're leading into the next Avengers movie, which, who are the Avengers?
Yeah, we kind of, like, it's the Thunderbolts.
Oh, really? Like, that's who we're going to call the Avengers? And Sam Wilson and nobody?
They're having a legal fight over the name, so.
Right, right.
Remember that? Okay. So it might not be, we don't know who the Avengers are going to be.
We're in a place where it doesn't really make a lot of sense that we're diving into Doomsday next, because I feel there's no cohesion as to why we would be getting to Avengers Doomsday next when I don't even know who the Avengers I'm supposed to care about are, you know? And so that's a really interesting thing. And so I think where we stand by the end of this is in a place of, my contention is that you should have ended this with Endgame and then allowed Fantastic Four to be the thing that catapulted us into a new universe.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I don't. I think the problem, and this is, you know, this is a problem that, and it's not exclusive to Marvel or, you know, to Disney. This is also a problem that Warner Brothers has with DC. Is there's just too much content out there that it's like, now DC has the advantage of that they're resetting everything and they're starting over from scratch. But the fact of the matter is, since Endgame, DC has also released a grand total of nearly 35 films and TV projects. And that's not even including the 30 DC animated studio films, which I don't count those because those are more for the hardcore geeks, you know, that want to watch Sons of Superman or, you know, something like that. It's all just so much noise. And you know, you're starting to see it with the international box office returns on all these films. It's just that I think we're reaching an apex point where I don't know that outside of like stunt type films, you know, like Daredevil, or not Daredevil, Deadpool and Wolverine, or Avengers Doomsday, you know, where it's like you get the whole gang back together kind of films. I don't know that what these studios are going to do with these projects going forward, because there's so much money on the line. And Marvel's in a not a great place, because they needed to soft reset everything after Endgame and take a pause, you know, even just a year. But everybody's afraid of that. And, you know, in Disney's mind, you know, streaming was going to fix everything. And then within 2-3 years, you know, here we are. Streaming's not fixing everything. So you got to keep going. Keep going until the wheels fall off kind of thing.
One of the things that I think in this discussion about where we stand at the end and just like, I mean, the state of the genre, you know, I think that one of the lessons that I think we've learned from the Marvel cinematic universe and what it can teach us is that you have to be very careful about creating a plan and sticking to it, and doing that and announcing projects so you do that at the expense of finished scripts and quality. And so part of that, I think, is this. It comes down to the kind of the difference between what we got with the prequel era and then what we got with the sequel era of Star Wars, right? Which was you just rush through everything, you barely think about it, you have no plan, and you just do it, which is the sequel era. The prequels, George Lucas taking his time, making a film, and then 3 years later, the next film will come out. So that first film gives you the reaction, it you know, all that stuff. And so that's what's interesting, I think, about the state of the genre, is that when you were looking at this shift of what's happening, where the thought of a film making $1 billion because the overseas market is just as big as the domestic market, that's changed. And so what you have to be doing then is making sure that the film is going to get the word of mouth that's going to draw people to the theater, which is the thing that I think, at least from what we've seen so far, James Gunn did take from his time at Marvel and is looking to institute with DC, which is to say, we're only going to do movies with finished scripts that we actually think are worthy of being produced. And if it's not working in the pre-production, we just cancel it, which they have done. And we're not doing 15 series and 3 films a year.
But the problem, even James Gunn's falling into this trap again, though, because at San Diego Comic-Con, he said the plan is 2 films a year, 2 TV shows a year, 2 animated shows a year, and then 2 of these, you know, DC animated studios films. I'm just like, that we're starting to get right back where we were before.
Well,
the problem for Marvel, yeah, frankly, is that they've released products out of order because stuff was supposed to release before this thing, and so they had to kill the original end credit scene, which was going to lead into the next film. Yeah, exactly. Now they filmed something that maybe relates to the next film, or maybe it doesn't, because we don't know. Like, do I think anything's going to come of the post-credit scene from Captain America Brave New World? No, I don't think anything's going to come of that scene at all in any film, in any project.
Right.
It was just a scene. You know,
well,
and that's a problem.
and that's the difference, though, because at least with James Gunn can say that, but what we're actually seeing is They only have two films in production right now. And that's because, and they weren't the choice in the sense of like, well, we have to do these movies because they are part of the story. It was like, hey, this Clayface horror film came in and we just thought the script was so good. We're like, we got to do this. Supergirl comes in. They love the script. They think we have to do this film next because it's ready. It's great. We think it's going to be a good. You know, they're working on other projects in the sense that of things that they would like to see happen. But those so far, if the trend follows, they won't do those projects until they think the script is good because they had things already in the works that they were like, no, that's just not working. And it's going to make everybody look bad if we keep continuing with it. So we just killed it. And so that's, I think, look, if in the era that we're in, I think, and where we stand in the end, the lesson that should be learned is make good movies and people will go see them. Because word of mouth is what drives people to the theaters more than anything else these days, because so many people are turned off by Rotten Tomatoes and all the stuff. We don't believe any of that anymore. It's all bought for. So if a friend, though, that I trust says, hey, that movie was good, I mean, goodness, that's what got my wife and I get to go see Mad Max Fury Road back in the day, because everybody was raving about it. Critics and my friends. So that's what you need to have happen.
Yeah, and I think the big lesson, I mean, for me at least with Marvel, they really need to go back to the formula. And I think this film kind of goes there, but I don't know what's going to happen down the road. The formula that worked for phases one and two, which were these films that were, the films could stand on their own. Like if you didn't see, you know, Thor or Thor Dark World, it didn't kill your enjoyment of, you know, the next film because you didn't know everything. But everything now is so, you know, especially with Marvel, is so interlocked with one another. It's like you have to see
the next thing.
Otherwise, you're kind of hosed. And that's a Kevin Feige thing. That's a mistake of his own making. He needed to follow what they were doing when it was more of a joint venture with all the other team members and Kevin Feige during phases one and two, which were these kind of what James Gunn's doing now, which are these one-off films that they're in the same universe.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily have to appear in each other's films. They can, and maybe we'll throw a loose thread here and there, but it doesn't have to be this kind of interlocked world, which, you know, everything has a potential endpoint, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's been the downfall. So
So it's going to be really fascinating just to kind of see what happens. And you know, again, this summer was such an interesting cauldron to throw everything into because, you know, we had the beginning of the DCU, and then we have this Marvel film kind of trying to kick off the next big phase of what's going to happen. And so how they do it, the box office and all this stuff and the reviews they get and what do people think about it and all that stuff, that's really interesting fodder. And what makes it interesting is because we're at this place where the genre itself is at a crossroads, right? And we have to figure out really a new way of doing things because we can't just bank on the fact that we're going to get the same amount of box office overseas as we're going to get domestically. And we're going to have to kind of go back in many ways to a almost 90s, early 2000s type of box office where if a film makes, you know, $500-600 million, dude, that is a huge hit. That's what we're looking for. And that's where, you know, you're going to have to be much more careful with the money. You're going to have to be, and this is where it comes in too. You need completed scripts. You need directors who know what they want effects-wise because the effects budget is going to have to be smaller, but it's going to have to then, if you truly have planned well in your filming, you know what you're looking for, it costs less because the artists don't have to spend so much time redoing things.
Yeah, so there was a good article today, it's July 30th, in Variety talking about that very thing. There was Variety was talking to a Marvel insider who was talking about the state of the superhero genre, and he said everybody is going to have to change the way they do things, because China's a non-market now for superhero films. It didn't matter if it was Superman or Fantastic Four. It was a non-entity. It's also the same thing in Japan. Both films are playing poorly in Japan. Yep. Part of it is because they've got another movie. They got Monster Hunter that's playing right now. Jurassic World did the smart thing and avoided Monster Hunter and is releasing in like 2 weeks, I think, in Japan. So they avoided July altogether. So what they've determined is they need to stop relying so much on Asian markets in particular, but just overseas in general, because there does seem to be a real big softening overseas to the genre in general. They're going to need to bring the budgets down. They're going to need to not be afraid to hire unknown actors, you know, so they don't have to spend money on these. I mean, there's talk that Robert Downey Jr. is getting like $300 million for Doomsday.
That's just ridiculous. That's
just ridiculous.
Yeah.
You can't make money like that.
No.
Yeah. You know, and that the budgets need to come down to like $120 to $150 million. And when you do that, then you can have a hit if your film makes $600,
$650. Well,
you know, where both of these films are going to fall at the end of the day, both Superman and Fantastic Four are going to fall in like the high, you know, for Fantastic Four, it's probably high fives. Superman will probably be $600, $620, which that's okay, but it's not the money they both actually needed to make because of the investment up front. But, you know, you can live with that if the promise down the road is, you know, you're going to consistently make more money, because you're keep, like Supergirl, I think the budget for that's only like $125 million.
Yeah.
So
they're playing it smart. Yeah.
That's playing it smart. Doomsday, on the other hand, that film has a rumored budget for like $1 billion. Yeah. I'm just like, good luck.
Well, and then the problem is that even if you make $1 billion, it doesn't make its money. Yeah. You don't actually make anything. And I think we're going to get back to a place too, where, the goal for an actor in the end comes down to it's going to be about the residuals, which is then going to be about the work, which is then going to be about the way we get butts in seats, right? And it becomes more about the performance. And in some ways, I think that only does we as the audience a service. Because when you have to work hard for something, it comes across on screen. When you just feel like it's owed to you, it doesn't come across on screen, right? And so I think that that only will do good things for us as the audience, which then in turn is actually going to be the thing that drives people to want to see these things, because everybody's going to tell them, hey, you got to see this, and you got to see it on the biggest screen possible.
Well, and the one great thing about this is by forcing these budgets to get lower, you actually may force writers and directors to come up with better ideas for stories that are smaller, that aren't necessarily these big end of the world, you know, cities falling to the ground kind of thing, where it's more of a simple, like, I would love to see a Superman movie that's a little more down to earth and, you know, a little bit more with his relationship with Lois and his family, you know, and a much more kind of intimate kind of Superman movie. I'd like to see, you know, a Spider-Man movie that's now, this is allegedly the rumor, that's a little more of a street level story. It's not so much a big spectacular, you know, big things exploding on screen kind of Superman movie. And that may be one of the benefits of this need to course correct, is that we may get more of a variety of stories versus what we're kind of getting now, which is all these, because we got to put this budget on the screen. You know, it's the old axiom from Star Trek, the motion picture, you know, when Robert Wise was trying to make this small kind of intimate character-driven story, and Paramount's continually telling them, no, you cut that. We need this big thing on the screen, because we paid all this money for the special effects. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's going to be, obviously, this has been a big conversation here at the end of the podcast, but I think it's an important one because this is where we are as fans, right? And if you're listening to this podcast, obviously, you're a fan of these type of films. You're in the know, right, about a lot of the stuff that's going on behind the scenes. And, you know, we've been doing this for the last 20 years of these universes, and we've reached this kind of like zenith point where we're on the other side of the bell curve. And so the goal for these studios is try to find a way back up. And so how do they do that? And that's been the stuff that we've been trying to figure out, just even as audience members. What are going to be the things that drive us to want to get to the theater to see these things? You know, because, you know, when it comes to Marvel just in general, I'm not going to see most of this stuff because I really want to. I'm going to see it because I do this podcast. And I wouldn't say that's a great reason for going to the movies. You know, when it comes to these type of things, you want to be excited about what's coming out. And so, with that in mind, Yancey, I am really interested to see where you're going to land with the ratings for Fantastic Four.
I am going to give this a very shockingly high 4 or 5. And the reason being is I really thought the story pacing, I thought it was the best representation of the Fantastic Four on the big screen. I thought it nailed all the parts that I needed as a viewer. But more importantly, it did a decent job of functioning as kind of a Marvel reset, albeit a short one. You know, it's a one film reset, let's be real. And then it's back to business as usual. So I thought this was a welcome respite from what has been a really rough couple of years for Marvel. So,
you know, I obviously, I'm not as high on the film as you are, and I think for me, you know, when it comes to, when I'm just looking at the list, at least of films, ones that I thought were enjoyable, you know, I was actually really surprised how much I enjoyed Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings. I thought that was a great, talk about phase one type feel of introducing a character. Obviously, No Way Home is in a league of its own in the sense of what it did. I thought Multiverse of Madness was really interesting, honestly. And then, really, the only other film that I've enjoyed was Guardians of the Galaxy 3. And so, coming into this one, I was very much hopeful that I would like this movie. And to me, I hate saying this, but I think this movie needed the scriptwriters to go through a few more iterations of the script to streamline some things and or make things more understandable, especially to those who don't understand these characters, especially since we're skipping over large portions of the story that make these characters who they are. And I think that casting needed to be better and or you needed the director to allow Pedro Pascal more freedom in his performance. And so with all of that in mind, this is not a bad film. Again, the score is incredible. The film looks great in the sense of its vision for the world it's created of this, you know, techno-utopia, futurism, authoritarian, you know, world that we're in. All that looks great. You know, it's really well thought out. It feels very real in that sense. So there's a lot to like about this movie, but I think the problem is that when I come away from it, it feels just aggressively fine, which is what a lot of Marvel movies have felt like recently. Thunderbolts was in many ways the same way. It's aggressively fine. This one is better than Thunderbolts. But I'm going to land at a 3 out of 5. And so that's not a terrible rating. Obviously, it's better than average. It's just, it's lacking what I think it really needed, which is really true, heart-rending emotional moments that drive you into these characters in a way that makes you really love them and be on their side and, like, yeah. So, I guess we'll be back in Marvel for Avengers Doomsday.
It's actually Spider-Man is the next movie.
No.
Yes. No. It's July 31st. It's the Spider-Man movie that just went into production yesterday, I think.
Really?
Because Doomsday got moved to November, December.
So they've switched places, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
It looks like it. So
interesting. So that's interesting.
And obviously, thing that raises some questions is they interviewed Mystique, because she's in the movie, Rebecca Romijn.
Yeah.
And she said that she finished her shooting, but she said she didn't know if she was coming back because they're still writing the script. I'm like, boy. What? You've been shooting for 2 months. How is this possible?
Yeah. So that's really interesting because it was my thought and understanding that Doomsday was next, but Brand New Day is next. Okay. All right. Well, we'll see how that goes. But thank you so much for everyone for joining us. Yancey, if people wanted to find you somewhere on the interwebs and talk more Marvel or see what else is going on with you, where would they reach out to you?
Yeah, they could my Twitter handle is Galandro1. That's a Star Wars reference to the Han Solo Adventures by Brian Daley.
For the initiated.
Yes. And also just my full name, Yancey Evans, on Facebook. I also have a blog that I every once in a blue moon update. It's called onesaga.wordpress.com. It's about Star Wars, my true love. And so that's where you find me. And sometimes tooling around in the 602 club. You find
that's
me every
right.
once in a while.
Oh, it's so great to have you here. And I'm really glad that we got a chance to do this. It was super fun. But you can find me all over the place under the name MattRushing02. You can also, that would be on social media. So if I'm on that platform, that's the name I'd have. You can also find me, of course, here on the network outside of the 602 Club with all the great Star Trek talk that Chris Jones and I do. We're back to Strange New World Season 3 over on Saddle Up, plus all the anniversary rewatches we're doing, so please check all those out. Over on the Nerd Party Network, you'll find me two shows. One is a completed show about Harry Potter, talking about every single chapter of that series, called Owlpost, and then the great John Mills and I are talking about Star Wars each and every week on Aggressive Negotiations. But thank you so much
for
joining
us. Great show, by the way.
Oh, Yancey, come on.
Every Star Wars fan should be listening to that show.
I appreciate that. We really do have a blast doing that show together, and so I do hope people will check it out. But thank you so much for coming in, and y'all come back now, you hear? ¶¶